This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Dori Toure. You're going to be joining us in Sierra Leone for a very special homecoming trip.
For many of our ancestors that were enslaved and taken from the mainland, this was the last stop where their feet was on African soil.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. There are fresh doubts about the durability of an agreement for a ceasefire in Gaza after the Israeli Prime Minister warned that he wouldn't proceed with the plan unless he received the names from Hamas of the first hostages due to be released tomorrow. The deal, ratified by the majority of the Israeli cabinet, is due to come into effect tomorrow, but Benjamin Netanyahu, in his first public statement since that ratification, made it clear Israel reserved the right to go back to war. He said he had the backing of the United States.
Before the next phases, we are keeping very significant assets in our hands in order to bring all the hostages home, in order to keep all the goals and objectives of the war. Both President Trump and President Biden have given full backing to Israel's right to return to combat if Israel concludes that negotiations on Phase B are futile. I greatly appreciate that. I also appreciate President Trump's decision to ensure that we will have all the weapons and ammunition that we need. If we have to return to fighting, we will do so in new ways, and we will do so with great force.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher in Jerusalem gave me his assessment of the Israeli Prime Minister's speech.
This is certainly wasn't a peace in our time speech, was it? It was very much that Israel retained the right to go back to war, that after this six-week first phase of this ceasefire agreement expires, and Mr. Netanyahu was very keen to stress that he had the backing of the United States to do so if he needed to do so, and that they had the assets that they needed to go and complete their objectives in Gaza if that was so needed. Yeah, so certainly not a message that gives one great confidence that this is going to be a lasting, permanent ceasefire, but the reason behind that is because there are lots of political factors here in Israel which make it very difficult for Mr. Netanyahu to talk about this being a permanent arrangement. And that's why often when we see statements from the government about it, they talk more about it being a hostage deal rather than being a ceasefire agreement, because it's more palatable to elements, particularly within Mr. Netanyahu's government.
He says the chief sticking point is the fact that he hasn't been given the names of the first three hostages to be released. Do we know whether that's spelled out in the agreement, that he has to have three names?
We don't, and I think, to be quite frank, this statement which came out from the Prime Minister's office late this afternoon saying that Hamas was violating the agreement because they hadn't provided the names of the hostages, I think that's probably going to turn out to be more of a hitch than a serious hold-up. We believe that three hostages will be released on Sunday. There's been lots of speculation that it would be possibly three female soldiers who would be released, and I think not in the publicly released draft of the agreement is anything about when people have to be notified, but there's a lot of protocols, more detailed technical stuff, which normally has been agreed between the two sides as to how things are going to work. And perhaps there is something in there which stipulates the names should be released the day before. Certainly Israel has released very long lists of the Palestinian prisoners, which it's intending to release not just tomorrow, but over the course of the 6-week period.
Yeah, it's such a difficult balancing act that less than 24 hours before this deal is due to come into effect, we're not really sure if it's going to stand.
There's lots of potential for things to go wrong. And in the complete absence of trust between the two sides, there's always going to be the risk that something will happen which could potentially threaten the whole thing. But for tomorrow, at least, it looks for now that things will proceed. Whether everything continues to go smoothly or whether there are hitches further down the line.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher in Jerusalem. Of the 33 Israeli hostages to be released initially under this deal, 12 are from kibbutz near Oz, where more than a quarter of the inhabitants were killed or kidnapped in the October the 7th attacks. 29 of them are still being held in Gaza, leaving a community scarred and waiting anxiously for the hostages' return. This report is from our Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson.
Family, whole family with three children, all were killed.
Kibbutz near Oz is a community of absent faces, burnt and empty houses, papered with photos of the missing. A quarter of the people here were killed or captured during the Hamas attacks. 15 months on, 86-year-old Natan Bahat is virtually the only resident to have moved back. Israeli airstrikes pounding Gaza a mile away.
Through this gate. Now it's closed, they open it and they enter.
This is where the Hamas gunman came through.
Yeah. They enter. I don't want to live in war all my life, or my children, my great children. No.
Do you think it's possible to win that war?
Win, it's not the right word, I think, to finish the war and to live with peace, with agreement.
Is it finished?
I don't know. I hope.
Everywhere you look in this kibbutz, there are yellow flags planted outside the houses. Each one marks a missing resident, someone who was taken from their homes on the 7th of October. Some of them have since been released. Some have been killed in captivity. But there are others who are due to be freed in this hostage deal. 15 months after the attacks, this kibbutz is still frozen and silent. Until all the hostages have come back, almost nobody else has chosen to return.
We don't know for sure if they will survive, and we don't know.
A dozen people kidnapped from near Oz are due for release in the first phase of the ceasefire deal, including 69-year-old Itzik Elgarat, kidnapped from the safe room in his house. His brother Danny was on the phone to him as the gunman broke in.
Told me that he is wounded in his hand. He didn't understand how, what's happening. And I tried to explain him how to stop the blood, and he just shouted the phone, Danny, this is the end, this is the end.
The family is now preparing to learn what happened to him since.
In just 15 months, but I try sometimes to remember his face or his talk or his and it's like I forget something, you know, at I don't know what his condition. I prepare myself to the worst case.
Hamas said last year that Itzik had been killed in an Israeli airstrike, but there's been no confirmation.
You know, my brother is 69 years old. There's young boys that we left back, soldiers, and that all their life it's in front of them. I don't know, I think if my brother's sitting there and one of the youngest sitting near him, I think my brother will tell them that take him, not me.
Israel's hostages are now one step closer to returning back to lives that were frozen on the day of the attack. But in the past 15 months, both they and their region have changed.
Lucy Williamson reporting. Israel's Justice Ministry says 737 Palestinian prisoners will be freed as part of this deal's first phase starting tomorrow afternoon. For more details on who they are, I'm joined now by the Palestinian journalist Dawood Kutab, who is the author of a book on peace plans for the Middle East called The State of Palestine Now. Welcome, Dawood. Tell us about some of the more high-profile Palestinians who now stand to be released, please.
Well, on this phase, which is basically the phase of civilians, most of those released are people who are not known and who have no political leadership role. The Israelis have delayed almost all individuals with leadership role. But there's two people that stand out in my eyes. One is a woman, a grandmother, Khalida Jarrar. She's a member of parliament, a woman activist who's been arrested a number of times without charge or trial. She belongs to a leftist Palestinian organization. And her arrest has brought a lot of attention. The other person who will be released, hopefully, is Mohammed Al-Halabi. Mohammed Al-Halabi is, he used to work for a Christian agency called World Vision. And the Israelis, I believe, wrongly accused him of converting or passing by $50 million worth of humanitarian aid to Hamas. This was never proven in court, but still he has been held in jail for like 7 years. Australia, the UN, and other agencies have all said that he's innocent, yet the Israelis have kept him in jail because he fit the narrative of the Israelis that money going for humanitarian aid was going to Hamas. In fact, the entire budget of World Vision in all these years doesn't reach the $50 million that he was accused of.
So not all of these prisoners are convicted of or even charged with crimes?
There is a mix. Many of them are what we call administrative detention, like Khalida Jarrar, no charge, no trial. Some have been convicted, and some actually have been convicted for a lifetime that will be released. But they are not known, and most have not been accused of physically killing Israelis, but basically helping the killing of Israelis, and they got life terms just for that. But the more well-known leaders like Marwan Barghouti, who many consider to be the possible next Mandela, there's no news whether he will be released or not in future exchanges, but this is one of the people that many Palestinians are hoping would replace President Abbas, who's 86 years old, and his government is not very popular.
Will all of those who are released be able to return home to their families?
We are told that some will be allowed to return to Gaza and the West Bank, but some will be deported to third countries. It's not clear yet who will be given this right to return home and who will be forced to find refuge in another country. So far, I know from my Gaza friends that Mohammed Halabi and others will be allowed to go back to Gaza, and Khalid Jarrar would be allowed to go to the West Bank.
Many thanks. That's Dawood Kutab, Palestinian journalist and author, talking to us live. You're with the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, live from the central of London. Much more to come. Coming up, the enduring importance of the legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald.
She is one of the people that defines the Great American Songbook, and that concept is still going strong to a large extent because of Ella Fitzgerald.
Goodbye.
We'll hear more about a newly discovered recording of a concert by Ella Fitzgerald in about 5 minutes. The main headlines: the Israeli Prime Minister says the Gaza ceasefire deal will be unable to take effect unless a list of hostages to be released by Hamas on Sunday is given to him. Nigerian officials say at least 70 people have been killed after a fuel tanker tipped and exploded northwest of Abuja. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from London. Now, two judges have been shot dead at the Supreme Court building in Tehran. Iranian state media said a gunman had infiltrated the building and martyred two brave and experienced judges. The victims both had a long track record in the persecution and sentencing of opponents of the Islamic regime dating back to the 1980s. One of them is known to have disproportionately sentenced young women to death for crimes such as distributing flyers. I've been speaking to Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian.
These were two judges, both clerics. They were notorious for their background in the persecution of political prisoners from back in the 80s up to the most recent decade. One of them is notorious actually for heavy involvement in the massacre of political prisoners in 1988. And the second judge is a person who is still in very recent memory for his very heavy sentences that he handed down to some of these civil rights activists and journalists and people of dual nationality. And some of them narrate really draconian stories of how he treated them in prison and how he handled himself at court.
What is the official government version of what happened at the moment?
The details are very sketchy. We don't know exactly who this person was, nor what his motives were. What they say is that he was an infiltrator who worked for the judiciary. That means that he was an employee working at the judiciary. That might explain why he managed to have access to the offices of these two judges and how he managed to shoot them. But given the political background of the two judges, their involvement in the persecution of political opponents, there's also a lot of speculation that the assassin may have been politically motivated.
Hard to judge, I suppose, but how would these two judges be viewed by the average Iranian?
Well, if you would have asked me that 20 or 30 years ago, a lot of people would have been happy because there's a lot of bitterness, but no one would have condoned the assassination because everyone was worried about setting off a cycle of violence. But ever since recent developments in Iran, the Women, Life, Freedom Revolution, and the crackdown on dissent, there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of bitterness among the Iranian public. So a lot of people are happy, and among the opposition, there is a sense of satisfaction, but there is division over whether they should condone it or not. We had one person, at least, the Iranian Nobel Peace Laureate. She said these judges had it coming. So that just gives you an indication of how the people feel about these kinds of things today.
Following the wave of protests by women against the hijab laws and now this, are you identifying a growing undercurrent of dissent in Iran?
Well, absolutely. There is an underlying current of dissent in Iran. But whether that translates into actually taking such measures like this, this hasn't happened before. People go out in the streets and they protest. But this kind of domestic opposition within the country of a militant kind, it's quite rare.
Enough to make the authorities nervous, perhaps prompt a harsh reaction?
Yes, a lot of people are worried now. We've heard expressions of concern by the opposition that this might be a pretext for more crackdowns and a more securitization of the political atmosphere in Iran, yes.
That was Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Dori Terray. You're going to be joining us in Sierra Leone for a very special homecoming trip.
For many of our ancestors that were enslaved and taken from the mainland, this was the last stop where their feet was on African soil.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Welcome back to NewsHour. A court in India has delivered a guilty verdict in the case of a man accused of the rape and murder of a female trainee doctor at a hospital in Kolkata last August. The discovery of the victim's body inside the hospital triggered nationwide outrage and prolonged protests by doctors across India. The suspect was a volunteer with the Kolkata police, and investigating officers from India's CBI have been accused of trying to protect their own. The BBC's Salman Ravi was in court.
So this was one of the most gruesome rape and murder cases that Kolkata, the city of joy, has ever witnessed. There was a lot of protests from different quarters, like the civil society, the junior doctors, who paralyzed the entire medical system for more than 2 months. And the people, they were on streets, cutting across barriers, like even women and children, they were on the streets. And this is one of the longest protests that this city has ever seen.
Tell us about the man who's been found guilty of this.
Sanjay Rai, he actually is a civil volunteer. It's an auxiliary unit of the Kolkata police. And that is the reason that the Kolkata police was in the dock, and people, the sentiments, they were flared up against the police department, and the police commissioner, ultimately, he had to be transferred. And the CBI, it arrested the principal of the college and the local police station officer in charge on the charges of tampering with the evidence. But the CBI has failed to produce a charge sheet against them, and they got bail from the court. And that has annoyed the parents of the victim. They were unhappy with the way the proceedings were being held by the CBI. They say that out of the more than 200 witnesses, 50 witnesses, they were not called to depose before the court. Then one more important thing that they have mentioned in their petition before the Supreme Court of India is that Sanjay Rai, being the only accused in the case, so if he was the only accused in the case, then why the principal and the officer in charge were arrested on the charges of trying to wipe off the evidence and larger conspiracy? If at all there was a conspiracy, then there could not have been just one person involved in it.
There is a wider debate here, isn't there, about the safety generally of medical staff in India. This woman was murdered inside the hospital.
Yes, it is. But for Calcutta, people say that it is more shameful because in Calcutta, the women are more empowered than the male. It's a place which has never witnessed such incidents before. And people, they were like very annoyed. And now even the women, they took out protests in the night because this incident had happened in the night hours. But still, the protests are going on right now. I'm here in the Sialdah court, and around me, there are so many protests happening. Bengali Nationalist Party is holding a protest. The junior doctors are holding a protest. There are other civic society members who are protesting because CBI had pleaded before the court, terming it to be a rarest of the rare case and demanding a capital punishment. Though the judgment did not come today, it will be delivered on Monday. The court has deferred it. But still, the accused has got many options left because this is a lower court, a designated court. He can appeal before the High Court. And after that, he can also appeal against the sentence or against the verdict in the Supreme Court of India.
The BBC's Salman Ravi in Kolkata. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. With 2 days to go until Donald Trump is sworn in for the second time as US president, there is proof, if it were needed, of his divisiveness as a political figure. In Washington, crowds of anti-Trump demonstrators have been making their feelings known. Protesters carried placards with messages and chanted slogans like "Lock him up." Meanwhile, the biggest gathering of pro-Trump demonstrators has been in Arizona. We'll be going there shortly. The groups in Washington have been marching towards the Capitol building to express their opposition to Donald Trump's stance on issues such as immigration and abortion. NewsHour heard from some of them.
It makes me kind of sick that Trump's back in office, or will be as of Monday. I think it's pretty bad, and it makes me sad to think that so many people are ready to take away women's rights. But women have had those rights for 50 years, and I don't think they're willing to go back.
My name is Mary Pelicano. I live in Maryland, and I am here for my daughter. She's not here, but I want to model for her what it looks like to show up for democracy. People sitting back and just letting things happen and being apathetic is what got us to this point now.
Do you feel let down by your fellow Americans?
Incredibly so. Incredibly so. But I owe that a lot to people being misinformed and not understanding that, you know, economics 101, you would understand that tariffs are not going to help the economy.
Some of the protesters on the streets of Washington voicing their opposition to the incoming president, Donald Trump. Now in Arizona, famously a swing state that voted for Donald Trump in November, lots of people have been showing their support for the president-elect as inauguration approaches. We can speak live to the BBC's Helena Humphrey, who's in Yuma County in Arizona. Helena, welcome. What are people there telling you?
I think for the most part, the sense we've been getting is one of excitement, perhaps a few nerves mixed in. Right now I'm at a local market. We're in a rural area. People have just been enjoying their Saturdays. A few talking about inauguration as they walk through the stalls selling things like hot sauce, Mexican food. As you mentioned, Arizona is a swing state which voted for Donald Trump. Yuma County, though, is really interesting. It's on the border with Mexico, and overwhelmingly, they voted for Donald Trump. So when you speak to people here, some of the things I'm hearing is they say that they hope things will be better than they had been the past 4 years. They say that they hope Donald Trump will bring peace globally, improve the economy. That's really a big one, of course, which we saw nationally. And then also with that proximity to the border, they also talk about bringing in tighter border policies. Now, I was meeting earlier today with a group of Trump supporters, and they met up in a car park and they were driving through the city of Yuma in what they called a victory caravan. So if you can kind of imagine it, it's like a convoy of vehicles. They're flying Donald Trump and J.D. Vance flags. They're beeping their horns, rolling down their windows, driving through the town and the desert roads to celebrate. Now, I spoke to one of the organizers. His name is Daniel Paz. Take a listen.
It's actually one of the funnest parts is when you're driving through and you get all those thumbs up. And in my experience, this last one, it's been heavily positive. It's probably been 90% positive compared to maybe 4 years ago. It was more of more 50-50, and this time around, it's been just way more positive.
So where you are, Helena, Yuma County, as you mentioned, is right on the border with Mexico. I imagine immigration must be a big topic. Tell us what you've been hearing on that issue.
It's such an interesting question here because you have a Latino majority population in Yuma County. As you mentioned, you know, I'm really close to the border, just minutes away. And at times during the Biden administration, the number of illegal crossings did reach record highs before President Biden put in executive actions. But there are many people here who cross the border to work on farms, other forms of skilled labor every day. And I met a farmer who told me, these people are vital for the economy to flourish, particularly the local economy, also to secure food supply right across North America. And he's worried these people have their papers, they come from Mexico every day, and that they could end up getting caught up in these promised mass deportation raids from President Trump or face stigma. But I will also say that we did see a big surge in popularity with the youth Latino vote for Donald Trump. And I spoke to one voter, Valentin Casillas, and I asked him why he thought that was.
As far as Latinos going big for Donald Trump, it's because of the values. You know, taking care of our children, our families, our finances, that should always be, I think it's common sense that what we want is in line with conservative values, which is Republican at this point.
One young Latino pro-Trump voter. Donald Trump has threatened tariffs on the neighbours, the likes of Canada and Mexico. Are people talking about that there?
It's sort of mixed. Where I am right now, they call this area, because it's so agricultural, they call it the winter salad bowl of North America. So there's rows and rows of lettuce, coriander, dates, as far as the eye can see. And those farmers are worried. They're worried about tit-for-tat tariffs, which could make their products more expensive, especially when their customers are in countries like Canada and Mexico and China. And all of that's coming at a time when there was a warning from the International Monetary Fund that Donald Trump's trade policies could hurt the global economy and also backfire on the United States as well. But I will say, when you generally speak to people here on the street, it doesn't really appear to be registering right now, because they remember what Donald Trump said at those rallies, promising to make America great again. Slogans such as drill, baby, drill when it comes to oil, fracking here. And in doing so, he promised to enrich them. And I think ultimately, that's what people here voted for.
So, well, 2 days to go until inauguration in Washington, D.C. Will it be a big television event? Is excitement building, do you think, where you are?
I think it certainly is, and I think it definitely will be a big television event anyway, right across the United States, but particularly now, considering the fact that it won't be outside as promised. So people who had got tickets to attend now will be looking for alternatives. It'll be doing very well for Washington, D.C. We'll be back there. And then, of course, also people, I think, will be watching it from home here in Arizona.
Many thanks for joining us. Helena Humphrey there of the BBC, live from Yuma County, Arizona. Now, political commentators are divided on whether Donald Trump's changes to the Republican Party represent a lasting transformation of a political movement that's existed since the 1850s, or a temporary departure from the norm. Heather Cox Richardson is a historian and author of A History of the Republican Party. I asked her first how she'd describe those changes under Trump.
What we have now is the Donald Trump Party. He has very deliberately destroyed the apparatus of the Republican Party to make everything loyal to him. And that does a number of things to the system. It certainly does something to the way that he will approach going forward, because what he is really interested in is things that will enrich him and his family and his cronies. So again, I think we're going to see corruption. We're going to see the real packing of our government with people who are above all loyal to him.
What do you think of Elon Musk being so close to the new president?
Again, as a historian, I think it is fascinating because, of course, the idea of the Trump base was that Trump was somebody who would return the government to the hands of the little guy. And, of course, the very first thing he did was to fall into bed with a man who was usually the richest man in the world. That's really interesting. But what I really have been very surprised by is that if you think about American history, and again, there are caveats to this, but in a broad way, America really has not talked about class since the 1960s, maybe the 1970s. We talk about cultural issues, and we talk about race, and we talk about gender. Sometimes we talk about religion. On December 4th, I think it was, a young man came up behind a chief executive officer for a major health insurance company and shot him and killed him. And there has been a really, to my mind, astonishing outpouring of support for the person who pulled the trigger. And that seems to me a really important cultural shift in this moment, where all of a sudden class is very much back on the table at the very moment that the Trump Party, the MAGA Party, is openly wedding itself to billionaires. And I, quite frankly, have no concept of how that is going to play out. In this moment, I know in the late 1890s, this sort of thing led to a real backlash against the wedding of the government to big business.
And yet, isn't it completely in line with history, in tradition, that a very rich man is powerful in politics? The Rockefellers, the Carnegies of this world, were in their day much richer comparatively than Elon Musk.
Yes, what you are identifying is part of a pendulum swing in American history that we have seen again and again. In the 1850s, we get the rise of an extraordinary wealthy group of elite enslavers in the American South who take over the Democratic Party and then take over the American government. And that, of course, led to our Civil War. You see the same thing in the 1890s when you get the rise of people like Andrew Carnegie, like J.D. Rockefeller, like J.P. Morgan, sometimes even bankrolling the U.S. government themselves. Out of that, again, we get the progressive movement in a backlash to that. You see it in the 1920s. when we get the complete control of the government by the Republican Party, a very distinctive iteration of the Republican Party. And in that era, too, when you get the concentration of business together with the government, we get, first of all, the Great Crash. And then from that, we get the rise of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the construction of the liberal consensus and the modern democratic liberal state in the United States. Maybe we're looking at the same thing. But what we haven't seen before is a political party that is entirely devoted to one single person and his family and cronies.
Do you think we're witnessing a temporary blip in the history of the Republican Party or a longer term change of direction?
The Republican Party, as it has always been, no longer exists. The party structure itself is gone. That being said, Trump has taken his people over the cliff of the party. And if you look through the history of the Republican Party, it does this pendulum swing and always it snaps back to its original roots. And you see the original roots with Lincoln, but you see it snapping back with people like Theodore Roosevelt in the early 20th century and with Dwight Eisenhower and people like Nelson Rockefeller in the middle of the 20th century. The Republican Party, its donor base, its emails, its structure, its bench, all of those things have now been leashed to the service of Donald Trump. But that being said, the ideology of the Republican Party, as it was constructed in the 1850s and the 1860s under people like Abraham Lincoln, is central to the DNA of America. The idea that what the government is supposed to do is to have people treated equally before the law and have equal access to opportunity and to have a right to a say in their government. And whether a new party calls itself Republican or forms out of the old party or says something else, that ideology will come back if history is any guide.
Heather Cox Richardson, historian and author of A History of the Republican Party. Now, don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but missed the live broadcast, an online version is available, updated twice a day. BBC NewsHour podcast is what you need to search for, and you can subscribe to the feed if you want to get it on a regular basis. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. A new scientific mission is getting underway in the depths of the Pacific Ocean, which could dramatically strengthen theories of life on other planets. Scientists have discovered lumps of metal on the seabed that they think are capable of producing oxygen entirely without sunlight. I've been speaking to the scientist leading the research into the potential of these metallic substances. His name is Professor Andrew Sweetman. He's from the Scottish Association for Marine Science.
What we call polymetallic nodules, or what is more commonly referred to as manganese nodules, they're black lumps of accretions that are found at the seafloor in a number of areas in the Pacific Ocean, around the Cook Islands, the Indian Ocean. And they are full of various metals like manganese, lithium, cobalt, copper. And we are looking into, or mankind is looking into, potentially mining these things from the ocean floor, a depth of around 4,000 to 5,000 meters. That's about 2.7 to about 3.2 miles down.
And they're of interest because they have somehow the ability to split water into its constituent parts. Is that right?
We have several hypotheses as to what might be causing the oxygen production that we've been seeing at the seafloor. But yes, one of the ideas that we have is that these mineral accretions, these polymetallic nodules that we want to remove from the ocean floor to make batteries, for example, for electric cars, they may actually be acting as natural batteries by themselves. That's just one hypothesis. That we have several hypotheses, but that's one of the things that we're hoping to test in this new project that's just launched yesterday.
And previously, it was always assumed that the only way of making oxygen on Earth was through photosynthesis.
That's what I was taught in primary school and high school and university. And as a result of that underlying truth that we've all been taught in biology classes, when we first started getting the data, which was showing the oxygen was actually increasing at the seafloor in complete darkness, where there is no possibility for any photosynthesis, that's when it really, really got interesting.
This sounds like a potential environmental nightmare for the deep oceans. And another thing, you can see why NASA would be interested, can't you?
Yeah, so we're in discussions with NASA, some people at the JPL in California. We're just this week, I'm about to send a bunch of manganese nodules over to them. They have a small project that is just starting up now to look at where they're going to try and simulate the conditions on the ocean worlds of Europa and Enceladus. These are the moons that orbit Jupiter and Saturn, respectively. So they're going to try and simulate the conditions at the ocean floor on these planets and see if they can start to get some sort of electrochemical reaction going on.
With a view to finding out whether that would be a cause for extraterrestrial life.
Yeah, so it's important to bear in mind that there is life that doesn't require oxygen, for example, anaerobic bacteria. So not all life requires oxygen, but aerobic life or oxygen-breathing life does require oxygen. So if this process were to be happening on other moons and planets, it could be creating an oxygenated environment. Obviously, these are questions with a big unknown. But, you know, that's what science is all about.
And the environmental implications of mining these things here on Earth?
It's well known that when you have disturbance at the seafloor at those depths, 2 to 3 miles, the ecosystem is so stable, it's very rarely impacted by anything. And so even a minor alteration to the ecosystem may have significant effects. And the recovery of these systems may take thousands to millions of years to recover.
Professor Andrew Sweetman from the Scottish Association for Marine Science. Now, the future of TikTok in the US remains uncertain after the Supreme Court upheld a ban this week on the massive Chinese social media platform. Donald Trump made it clear he'd changed his mind and become a TikTok fan and said in an interview today that it was most likely he would give it a reprieve. For now, though, the ban remains in place and due to come into force tomorrow. TikTok was outlawed for similar reasons of national security in India in 2020. Before that, India was TikTok's biggest market globally. I've been talking to a motivational speaker and content creator whose TikTok accounts have more than 12 million followers. She goes by the name of Geet and she lives between the US and India.
When I was in India, I would go into the slums. I'd be able to reach maybe 20 people, 100 people. But when I got on TikTok, I saw the power of social media and the power of TikTok in particular, where I could reach millions of people with a message. I could teach English to millions of people. And when TikTok disappeared overnight, virtually, I lost 12 million people that I was able to help. And it was devastating.
And do you think the ban will be as devastating in the US?
I think it will be, and maybe even more so, because in the US, I know that there's so many creators and so many small businesses that are relying on TikTok for their livelihood. And at the time in India, I remember reading someone had equated the ban to you've built up this business and a fire comes and destroys it overnight. In these past 5 years that TikTok has been banned in India, in the US, they've come up with so many more monetization strategies so that creators and small businesses can make a livelihood.
Entrepreneurship finds a way, though, doesn't it? And there are other platforms and they will adapt and move, surely.
What TikTok does and the reach that TikTok provides even small creators, honestly, is not there on other platforms.
Your motives for being involved with TikTok are actually quite unusual. I'm guessing that you don't make a huge income from it.
No, I don't.
For most people, it's transactional. And indeed, for the owners of TikTok, it's entirely transactional, including, presumably, harvesting your data. How do you feel about that?
I feel like every platform harvests your data, honestly. So I don't think, as far as I know, I don't feel like TikTok is harvesting our data in any way that other platforms are not doing that.
And do you think that there are lessons that can be learned from Indian content creators and how they adapted and survived that American ones can look to?
Definitely, we do need to diversify wherever you're at. Don't rely on just one platform. But at the same time, there's so many creators in India that virtually disappeared after the TikTok ban. And that was really hard, especially because there were so many creators that came from below the poverty level at the time, and TikTok had given them a voice and a platform. And when that disappeared, they were not able to fit into the aesthetic of the other platforms. And that was difficult. But definitely the lesson to be learned is that we need to always diversify, that these platforms are not ours, then we do not have control over the audience that we build on these platforms. And so we do need to learn, figure out how we can make our audience ours, whether it's through email lists, whether it's through WhatsApp lists. We should always diversify.
That was Geet, Indian-American content creator on TikTok, and that was NewsHour for a Saturday evening UK time. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye for now.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Dori Teray. You're going to be joining us in Sierra Leone for a very special homecoming trip.
For many of our ancestors that were enslaved and taken from the mainland, this was the last stop where their feet was on African soil.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.